Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started. And if people join late, that's fine. I think we have most of our participants here. So, welcome everybody to our webinar at Cornell University. It's wonderful to see so many people joining us on this Monday afternoon, March 1st, 2021. My name is Jason Mokhtarian. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Near Eastern Studies here at Cornell, where I hold the Herbert and Stephanie Newman Chair in Hebrew and Jewish Literature. I'm honored today to be able to introduce our speaker, Dr. Abigail Manekin Bamberger of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, whose talk is entitled Jewish Religion in Talmudic Babylonia, the Evidence of the Aramaic Incantation Bowls. This talk is sponsored by the Jewish Studies Program with the support from the Religious Studies Program and the Department of Near Eastern Studies. Before introducing our distinguished guest, I would like to invite all of you to join the Jewish Studies program again this Wednesday, March 3rd, from 5 to 6:15 p.m. for another fascinating virtual event called Nice Jewish Rapper, Drake's Detachable Judaism and Racialized Masculine Mobility. You can register for free on the Jewish Studies program website. And while on the site, we also encourage you to subscribe for the Jewish Studies program newsletter to receive weekly updates on future events. Our speaker today is Dr. Abigail Manekin Bamberger, who is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Martin Buber Society of Fellows in Jerusalem. This coming July, she will be joining the faculty of the Department of Jewish History at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Her research focuses on the social and cultural history of Jews in antiquity, with a special emphasis on Jewish society in the Persian Sasanian Empire. She's published works on various aspects of rabbinic literature, ancient Jewish magic and demonology, and ancient Jewish culture within its broader context, including a recent article entitled, Who Were the Jewish Magicians Behind the Aramaic Incantation Bowls, published in the Journal of Jewish Studies. After her talk, we will have time for a Q&A session. So if you would like to ask a question, please type it in the Q&A tab at any time during the lecture, and I will moderate the session by choosing from the questions and reading them aloud. So without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Abigail Manekin Bamberger.
Hello, everyone, and good afternoon. I would like to first say thank you for this invitation. It's a pleasure to be here virtually, and thank you especially to Jason Mokhtarian for inviting me. So I can't see you, but you are supposedly here. So it's a bit like demonic presence, no offense, of course, that the rabbis say, you know, that the demons are surrounding you, but you can't see them, and it's lucky it's that way, but it's the same with angels, so maybe I should have said angels. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen and begin. So the Babylonian Talmud, compiled between the 3rd and 6th centuries CE, is the principal surviving literary source for the Jewish communities in the Sasanian Empire. As a result, scholarship has primarily focused on the rabbinic elite represented in and responsible for the Talmud, often painting a rather narrow picture of Sasanian Jewry. This accepted scholarly approach has recently been complicated by the discovery of hundreds of Jewish magical amulets written on bowls. Yet since their discovery, the bowls have been largely relegated to the domain of syncretistic or popular culture, contrasted with that of the high scholastic rabbinic elite. The Jews who used these amulets were often deemed uneducated and unable or unwilling to differentiate between Jewish and pagan and between learned and vulgar beliefs. The widespread narrative of Babylonian Jewish society constructs a binary model with two monolithic strata, the rabbinic elite and their followers on the one hand, and the uneducated masses and their magic formulae on the other hand. In my presentation today, I will argue that this dichotomy between the world of the rabbis and that of the magic bowls is artificial and difficult to maintain. A close reading of the bowls revealed that they were produced by different groups of professional Jewish scribes, some of whom had expert knowledge of Jewish legal formulae and rabbinic traditions. Likewise, rabbinic literature provides ample examples of the knowledge and practice of magical traditions akin and at times identical to those found in the incantation bowls. Moreover, reading rabbinic legal terms and institutions in light of the incantation bowls reveals that their meaning was often entangled with magical connotations, a point often missed when studying these two corpora in isolation. The bowls, therefore, offer a rare and alternative vantage point from which we may rethink rabbinic law and practice, as well as ancient Jewish society at large. But first, a few introductory words regarding the incantation bowls. So the Aramaic incantation bowls, dated to the 5th to 7th century CE, were generally intended to protect households from demons, curses, and malice. Some bowls were intended for other purposes, such as success in business, cursing enemies, gaining favor in the eyes of named individuals, and more. A scribe wrote incantation, divine names, curses, and spells in ink on the surface of an earthenware bowl, usually in a spiral fashion, as you could see in this photo. Later, the bowl was buried, usually upside down, in a home of a named client who commissioned it, as you could see here, that bowls that were found in Nippur. Some bowls include illustrations of usually of demons or demonesses bound in chains. This, for example, is an image of a bowl with a chicken-like demon from the Oriental Institute Museum at the University of Chicago, and such examples could be multiplied. Here is a slide with pictures taken from Naama Viložny's work, who copied the illustrations on the bowls. And you could see her work is very interesting and you could read more about that. But I just to point to a few features like the disheveled hair and the exaggerated genitalia, you could see demons bound in their arms and in their legs, etc. So there are around 600 bowls, published bowls, and more than 1,500 that still remain unpublished. Only a few hundred bowls are provenanced, mostly coming from Nippur, modern day southern central Iraq. Most of the bowls are written in Jewish, Babylonian, Aramaic, and in square Hebrew letters, while others are written in Syriac and Mandaic. Sorry. The bowls are primarily dated to the 5th to 7th century based on archaeological evidence of the provenanced bowls, as well as a number of unpublished bowls that provide explicit dates according to the Seleucid era. And I'll talk a bit more about that later. Other than a few dozen Jewish seals, the incantation bowls represent our only surviving material evidence from Jews in the Sasanian Empire in late antiquity. This was a crucial time in Jewish history, as this was the period when the Babylonian Talmud was redacted and transmitted, a period that therefore shaped the course of Judaism for generations to come. The bowls, therefore, provide us with firsthand and contemporary knowledge of Jewish practices at a formative time, knowledge that we would not gain from reading the Talmud alone. One of the fundamental enduring questions regarding these artifacts is who wrote these bowls. At first glance, this question seems impossible to answer. There is no signature of a scribe nor any external evidence of bowl writing practices. Turning to the many scholarly editions of the bowls does not provide us with a clear answer either, a reality made apparent by the lack of consistency in how scholars describe these writers. Scholars will typically adopt several descriptions, such as scribes, practitioners, or professionals, if they wish to emphasize the writer's expertise, or exorcists, magicians, or sorcerers, if they wish to emphasize their field of expertise. But who were these practitioners? How were they perceived by society? And what was the relation between them and the rabbinic elite? In several recent publications, I argued that a close study of the language of the bowls demonstrates that their writers possess expert knowledge befitting scribes of Jewish society. See, for example, this provenance bowl from that resides at the University of Pennsylvania Museum collection. This bowl was written for a woman by the name of Komish, daughter of Machlafta, and was intended to divorce demons by using accepted language of the Jewish divorce document, the Git. Divorcing demons through human legal divorce formulae is very common in the Jewish bowls, and in some cases was even borrowed in the Syriac bowls, as we will see in a moment. Scholars such as Shaul Shaked from the Hebrew University have suggested that the use of the divorce in the bowls is metaphorical, However, I argue that attention to the specific divorce terminology employed in the bowls teaches us that it was actually intended quite literally. So I'm just going to read the bowl lines from the bowl that was intended for Komish. This day of all days, years and generations of the world, I, Komish, daughter of Machlafta, have dismissed, released, and divorced you, Lilith. You are sent away naked and you are not clothed, your hair disheveled behind your backs. It is heard regarding you, whose mother is Palchan and whose father is Palchadan. Lilith, hear and go out and do not trouble Komish, daughter of Machlafta, in her house. We see here an opening formula with a vague time designation, followed by a declaration of divorce from Komish to the Lilith demon, expressed in the first person. The scribe then describes the various demons who are sent away shamefully, and the description may remind you of the images we saw before. He ends by listing the client Komish by using the third person, do not trouble Komish, daughter of Machlafta. The use of the first person divorce rhetoric reflects ancient Jewish scribal practices already attested in Jewish divorce document in a Jewish divorce documents from Masada from the first century CE, as well as in early rabbinic literature from the beginning of the third century CE. More geographically proximate, the Babylonian Talmud quotes divorce formulae that bear strong resemblance to Komish's contemporaneous magic bowl. In the table on the screen, you can see these Talmudic quotes, translated obviously, compared to Komish's bowl and to a parallel bowl made by the same scribe for a male client, Hornik, son of Achat. Following the first person address, the bowls then employ three Aramaic verbs of divorce, shavak, patar, and tarach. Interestingly, the Talmud only has two, which may suggest that there are some differences in legal formulae employed by the two groups. However, Jewish divorce documents from the Gaonic period, that is Babylonian rabbis from the 7th to 12th century and onwards, use these three verbs as well. The divorce formulae on the bowls not only parallels those of later rabbis, but is our earliest evidence for changes in Jewish divorce formula that are found later in rabbinic texts. Now, this similarity between the bowl of Komish and Honik and the contemporary Jewish divorce document is hardly unique. It is part of a much larger phenomena of use of Jewish legal formulae that I found in the bowls that includes, for example, and this I'm just going to skim over, we have time designations, for example, the general time designation we saw before, or dates, self-designations from the realm of legal documents. When I say self-designations, I mean that a bowl starts by saying, this is a divorce document, Haden Gita, or this is a document, Hadai Garta, etc. We have Jewish legal formulae and Jewish divorce formula, which, for example, the divorcing demons according to the law of Moses and Israel, or using the additional words and any name she has or in any name he has to present the client, which accords with the rabbinic instruction that in divorce you must give all the names of the divorcee and also the man who divorces, perpetuity clauses, and closing formulae such as amen, amen, or this is true, etc. The consistent employment of legal formulae by the scribes occasionally leads to surprising consequences. For example, in a Jewish writ from Masada, dated to the first century CE, there is a formula that expresses the permission given to the divorced woman to remarry if she so desires. This sentence is a crucial part of the Jewish divorce document, as we see later in rabbinic literature, so much that without it, the divorce is not valid. In a number of bowls, the scribe of the bowl employs the permission clause, thus giving the demonic divorcee permission to be with another. For example, in this bowl, this is the deed of divorce of the accursed Lilith, which I have written for Imi, daughter of Kakai, and any name that she has. And the Lilith who massacres her own children and the children of her companions, in order that you may have authority and power over yourself to any man that you wish. This is said to the Lilith. For I have written to you a deed of divorce and a document of release from this Imi, daughter of Kakai, from her house, from her children, and any name that you have. So as you could see on the screen, the sentence is very similar to the divorce already in the Masada Bill from the first century. The presence of the statement of permission in the bold indicates that the scribe was proficient in precise legal jargon. Moreover, despite the problematic consequences of giving, or immoral even, of giving permission to demons to conjoin with another human, the bold scribes did not relinquish the formula, but rather retained it, thus employing the correct and expected divorce formula. Another example of using precise formula in the bowls is those who have specific dates. And this is very rare to have in a magical document or magic book or magical amulet. It's very rare to have a date. And here, for example, we have a divorce formula. Those who read Hebrew letters, you could see here the Gita Katvit. I have written a divorce document, Hebrew letters in Aramaic, of course. So this photo that is taken from auction house website, unfortunately, the bowl is also sold in case you had any interest in this. So it says here, I have written a divorce document on the fourth day of the week. That is the 28th day of the month of Av, the 919th year, King Chosro. The date is written according to the Seleucid era, which means it comes out 608 CE. And King Chosro mentioned here is Chosro II, that reigned from 590 to 628 and was the last significant king of the Sasanian Empire. So altogether, there are around 20 different Jewish legal formulations that I have found in the bowls. So the scribes clearly made an effort to use pervasive and legally valid language, meaning that the divorce, in my opinion, was not understood as a metaphor, rather as something quite literal. The appearance of the various legal formulae is best explained by the training and the knowledge of the scribes. The extensive knowledge of scribal formulae, and indeed in some cases even scribal practices, reflect that some of the bowl writers may have been part of a scribal guild. Yet their scribal knowledge was not limited to legal formula that they employed. For instance, one bowl found in an archaeological excavation in Nippur is composed entirely from biblical passages and their Aramaic translation, which is almost identical to the traditional accepted Aramaic translation of this period, Targum Yonatan. We also find various liturgical formulae in the bowls, such as this bowl that has an extensive quote of the liturgical prayer Shema Yisrael. And as you could see, this is derived from liturgy and not just biblical verses, because it employs the liturgical response Baruch Shum Kevodo, Baruch Shem Kevod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed, blessed be the name of his glorious kingdom forever and ever. And there are other examples of liturgical quotes. For example, I'm working now on liturgical blessings that we know from rabbinic literature and later prayer books, Jewish prayer books that appear for the first time sometimes on bowls or that are parallel to rabbinic literature. So my argument regarding the scribal profession of the practitioners of the magic bowls fits the material aspect of the bowls as well. The bowl practitioner carefully uses ink in order to write small square letters on a surface of a bowl. And this is quite different from the contemporaneous Jewish magical finding from late antique Palestine of metal amulets, lamellae, which are inscribed in Jewish, Palestinian, Aramaic, or Hebrew. The craftsmen of the Palestinian metal amulets engrave letters with a stylus. And this is a very different, unique skill set unrelated to scribal practices. So this would explain that in the amulets, the Jewish amulets from late antique Palestine, we do not find legal formulae and we don't find the use of divorce. The penmanship of some bowls are particularly striking and they exhibit some bowls were professional scribes. My initial research demonstrates that there may be some sort of correlation between the quality of the handwriting and learned content of the Jewish bowls and also of the Syriac and Mandaic bowls. It seems therefore quite likely that these both scribes would have composed other Jewish legal documents or biblical scrolls, etc., diversifying their potential source of income. Okay, so my conclusion regarding the different historical and professional contexts of the various magical artifact problematizes the common use of the generic term Jewish magicians or Jewish magic. This term apologetically distances magic from other intellectual domains, but it does not adequately represent the differing professional and social background of the, in this case, the metal amulets and the bowls. Moreover, using the term magician or sorcerer to describe practitioners of both corpora erases the unique professional nature underlying each corpus. By viewing these corpora separate from one another, we are able to better situate the producers within their own unique context. Lastly, the term Jewish magician is meant to contrast them with other Jewish religious experts about whom we have knowledge, the rabbis. Yet, once we appreciate the extent to which both scribes employ Jewish formulae, we are less inhibited from observing how rabbinic literature depicts some rabbis as experts in the formulae necessary to dismiss demon. For instance, in this Talmudic passage from Babylonian Talmud, from the Babylonian Talmud tractate Psachim. Reeds that are near the city have no less than 60 demons. A certain town official went and relieved himself among the reeds and was endangered. A certain sage came and wrote for him an amulet against one demon. He did not know that the reeds held 60 demons. He heard them, the demons, rejoicing and singing in it. Master's scarf is like that of a sage, but we have examined him. He does not know how to bless. A certain scholar came who knew that the reeds held 60 demons, and he wrote an amulet for 60 demons. He heard them, the demons, say, remove yourselves from here. This Talmudic story tells of rabbinic sages attempting to exorcise 60 demons from reeds that they inhabit. The first one fails to do so because he designated the amulet for only one demon. The demons mock the sage by singing to him that he is indeed dressed like a rabbi, but he does not know how to bless, which is a euphemism for curse. Another rabbinic sage writes the correct formula for all 60 demons and succeeds in exorcising them. This passage may teach us a number of things. First, there is a need for precision that we may call legal in exorcising demons. This matches what we saw in the bowls that have that employ legal formulae. Second, the people who exorcise the demons are not described as magicians or sorcerers, rather rabbis or sages. Third, rabbis are supposed to be able to exorcise a demon. That explains why the demon mocked the first sage, that he looks like a rabbi, but he can't achieve such a basic thing as cursing demons. This is compatible with many other rabbinic passages that include various instructions to ward off demons and combat disease. Once we appreciate these Talmudic passages, alongside the conclusion that many bowl scribes emerge from a professional scribal context, the rigid binary between rabbis and magicians begin to unravel. Yet Jewish legal formulae was hardly the only content on the bowl incantations. Many bowls in Jewish Aramaic employed a wide variety of motifs drawn from Mesopotamian traditions, Christianity, and also from broader magical tropes found in Greek and Roman traditions. For example, in the bowl on the screen, published by Dan Levine, we find this concluding formula. By the name of I am that I am, Yahweh Tzavaot, and by the name of Jesus who conquered the height and the depth by his cross, and by the name of his exalted Father, and by the name of the Holy Spirit, forever and eternity, amen, amen, sera, this press is true and established. This scribe, as you can see, wrote in beautiful Jewish Aramaic script, but instead of invoking the perhaps expected kosher deities, he invokes the Trinity as a binding power. Yet while the case of the Trinity is especially noteworthy, this kind of invocation fits numerous examples in which scribes of bowls in Jewish script incorporate elaborate non-Jewish motifs. Alongside bowls that have elaborate religious motifs, such as the Jesus bowl and the Jewish ones we have seen, we also find many bowls that are formulaic and do not display unique content at all. In addition, there is a large number of bowls written in pseudo script with seemingly no unique content at all. And this is a subject of much discussion between Bol scholars. What is the meaning of this pseudo-script Bol? Is it charlatans, or as Daniel Waller argued, does this have meaning? And I could elaborate more in the discussion. So this large spectrum of content had led scholars to describe the bowls as syncretistic, part of a local koine produced by one group of magicians or sorcerers, and all reflective of a single corpus and a single strata of Jewish society. However, in a forthcoming article, Simcha Gross from University of Pennsylvania and I argue that the Jewish incantation bowls should not be viewed as a single corpus. Rather, the bowls were produced by different groups of scribes, some of whom were socialized according to rabbinic norms, and some of whom were closer to the traditions of neighboring religions. Though the medium they employed, ceramic bowls, was the same, their producers were not necessarily part of the same scribal guilds. Indeed, while scholars have noted the presence of some rabbinic traditions and motifs in the bowls, something that they argued with that is part of a general popular koine of the bowl writers, a study of the distribution of rabbinic literary traditions and motifs reveal that they often concentrate on a select number of bowls. Many of these bowls also appear to avoid motifs that might have clashed with rabbinic ideas and stipulations. On the other side of the spectrum, there are bowls that contain only non-Jewish themes and motifs and do not display specific Jewish tradition, such as the bowl we saw with the invocation of the Trinity. These results should suggest that the bowls were produced by different Jewish scribes with different proximity to and affinity for the rabbis and their teachings. The bowls that display expert knowledge of Jewish motifs are usually divided into two kinds: bowls that display a clustering of a variety of Jewish motifs, and bowls that cite a single lengthy Jewish tradition or motif as the primary incantation. For example, this bowl, Musayof 164, quotes from a wide variety of Jewish literature. This includes, and I'll again go over this quickly, it includes biblical passages from Daniel and Isaiah, a Mishnah quote from Tractate Shavuot, which in the original context is a Mishnah that deals with legally binding adjurations that a litigant may use to force a potential witness to come forward and witness. So the scribe selects or cites only the legally binding names in a intelligent quote of the Mishnah. He also, there's also a parallel to the Babylonian Talmud regarding the angel Metatron, liturgical formula, parallel from early mystical literature, and excommunication formula in the name of Rabbi Yoshua, son of Perachia. This wide array of different texts quoted in one single bowl attests to an erudite scribe knowledgeable in many Jewish texts and genres. Other scribes cite a single rabbinic tradition, which did not necessarily exhaust their knowledge of Jewish tradition, but displayed the import and power they ascribe to it. For instance, two bowls cite Mishnah from Tractate Zvachim, sacrifice, that contain rabbinic description of sacrifices in the temple. In both bowls, the Mishnah is introduced with the word Bishum in the name of, clearly treating these rabbinic texts as effective utterances in their own right. Beyond identifying particular bowls that display concentrations of Jewish traditions, we have identified a few scribes that consistently integrate various clusters of Jewish motifs in their bowls. The scribe of the multiple bowls on the screen, for example, included in his bowls, quotes from early Jewish mystical texts, quotes from Jewish prayer, a spell against a demon that we find also in the Talmud, a mythical story, Historiola, regarding an encounter of a rabbi, Hanina ben Dosa, and a demon that appears very similarly in the Talmud and Tractate Shabbat. Once we acknowledge that the bowl corpus should not be seen as a homogeneous corpus reflecting popular beliefs and practices from a specific and often lower social stratum, we are able to offer a richer portrait of Babylonian Jewish society. Different scribes reflect their different levels of proximity to and engagement with the rabbis, But these different groups simultaneously shared a medium, a craft, or even a business. Any effort at simply dismissing the bowls or even the poles that employ non-Jewish motifs as the work of a lower and isolated stratum of Babylonian Jewish society fails to explain this evidence or the evidence cited above of rabbis displaying expertise at expelling demons. At the same time, the somewhat romantic attempt to treat the Babylonian rabbis as the sole religious elite of their time, shaping the religious world of most Babylonian Jews, is no longer plausible, as the bull riders themselves may have been perceived as religious elites as well. How are we on time? Okay, we're fine. So beyond reflecting the varying proximity bull scribe had to the rabbis, the bulls reveal much about veneration of rabbis in Sasanian Babylonia, at least among some Jews. First, there are about a dozen bowls that mention rabbinic clients, as Shaul Shaked has shown. For example, this bowl was written for one Rav Ashi, son of Machlafta, a name that may fit a prominent rabbi from the 5th century who is traditionally seen as responsible for the redaction of the Babylonian Talmud. However, it is difficult to offer a precise identification as rabbinic literature gives the patronymic, whereas the magic bowls list the metronymic. And an initial study of the bowls written for rabbis revealed that they usually contain diverse Jewish motifs and avoid appealing to non-Jewish deities. In addition to mentioning rabbis as clients, other bowl incantations invoke rabbis and particularly their legal prowess as powerful apotropaics. The most widely attested example is that of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Parachia, who appears in early rabbinic literature and who is said to have lived in the 2nd century BCE. For example, in the bowl published from Neve and Shaked on the screen, just as there was a Lilith who strangled human beings and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Parachia sent a ban against her, but she did not accept it because he did not know her name. And her name was written in the deed of divorce and an announcement was made against her in heaven by a deed of divorce that came from across the sea. So you too are roped, tied and suppressed, all of you under the name, under the feet of this Marnica son of Kala. In this magic bowl, we have a magical legend, a historiola, that refers to the attempt of Rabbi Yehoshua to ban a strangling Lilith, a female demon, and his failure to do so because he did not know her name. Later, a heavenly divorce document is handed to Rabbi Yehoshua, with which he successfully divorces the strangling Lilith. The power of this mythical moment is invoked in order to protect the client, Marnica. Other references in the bowls to Rabbi Yehoshua are also exclusively connected to either his divorce document or his ban. It is important to stress that in this case, Rabbi Yehoshua is invoked in a different way than the bowls invoke holy names or angel. He is invoked here as a potent producer of legal deeds, either as casting a ban, performing divorce, or serving a legal document. This may reflect the view that rabbis were authoritative and possessed binding legal power, but the importance of the legal power is employed in mundane contexts, such as banishing evil demons. The invocation of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Parachia was so popular that he appears also in a couple of Syriac bowls, for example here, where he also produces a document to banish demons. Like it was when Rabbi Yeshua bar Parachia sat and wrote against them a document, Dastabira, against all demons and devs. Here, a bowl written in Syriac and Manichaean script clearly adopts the Jewish figure of Rabbi Yehoshua, along the motif of the divorce by using a Persian loanword, dastwar, meaning document, as Shaul Shaked has shown. In addition to Yehoshua ben Parachia, who somehow made the jump from rabbinic expert to popular magical motif, some bowls refer to recent or even contemporary rabbis. In an unpublished bowl, generously shared with me by James Ford, we find the following invocation: by the ban of the land of Israel and by the ban of Babylonia and by the ban of the rabbis of the land of Israel and by the ban of the rabbis of Babylonia, may she, the demoness or Lilith, be banned and excommunicated. The invocation mentions the land of Israel and Babylonia, followed by the rabbis of the land of Israel and the rabbis of Babylonia, Rabbanan de Ara de Israel and Rabbanan de Babel. This quote makes it clear that the bowl is referring to the major two centers of the rabbinic movement. We once again see the scribe invoking rabbis and specifically their legal deeds, in this case, their ban or excommunication, as potent magical precedent. A further invocation to a more recent rabbinic figure, recent to them, not to us, is also found in Bol, published by Krista Muller-Kessler, which invokes one Rabbi Acha bar Rabbi Chanilai, and I should say republished, published with correction by Matthew Morgenstern and James Ford. So you could see here, and by the ban of Rabbi Acha son of Rabbi Chanilai, Rabbi Acha bar Rabbi Chanilai. So this rabbi is not a Palestinian or a distant figure, it's the demons, like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Prachya, but refers to a Babylonian sage closer to the time of writing this bowl. In fact, this rabbi likely appears in rabbinic chronographies from the 9th to 10th century, such as the earliest rabbinic chronography, Seder Tanaim Amoraim. He lists Rav Acha bar Rabbi Chanilai as a Savora, placing him in the early 6th century. And lastly, there is a bowl that also from hasn't been published yet from the Musaf collection, which is currently in the National Library of Israel, that we see here at the external side of the bowl. May you be under the ban of the academy heads or Rashi Metivta veRabbanan and the rabbis. Meaning here the invocation is not just to individual rabbis, but to institutional or organizational structures, which also were seen as something that can be invoked for power, which could teach us a lot about questions of urbanization, questions that haven't yet had much scholarship in the scholarship of Babylonia, in contrast to contemporary Palestine, where there's a lot of more material, archaeological material and other material. So I'll now talk a bit, just conclude with a few things, and I think I'm going to stop sharing, even though I still don't see you. Okay, so the presence and invocations of rabbis in the incantation bowls on the one hand, and the phenomenon of Jewish Babylonian Aramaic bowls with clusters of Jewish traditions and motifs on the other, offer a novel view of Babylonian Jewish society and the positions of the rabbi within it during the end of the Talmudic period. These references are all the more significant if we do not assume, as scholars often have, that the Babylonian rabbis quickly rose to positions of prominence among the broader Jewish Babylonian community. Once we do not simply assume that the rabbis always enjoyed recognition in Babylonia, the bowls provide us with our first evidence that at least some Babylonian Jews both imbued the title of rabbis with respect and venerated rabbis for their legal powers and expertise. In terms of the rabbis, the bowls reveal that at least some Jews recognized and esteemed them and invoked their legal prowess as individuals and as a collective in incantations in a manner unprecedented in other Jewish amulets or in the contemporary incantation bowls in Syriac and Mandaic. Simultaneously, a closer examination of the distribution of certain motifs throughout the bowls suggests that certain scribes had greater proximity to the rabbis and their teachings than others. We have then a more complicated view of Jewish society where rabbinic figures are known and venerated, but actual relation to them and their teachings was by no means universal. The proximity between the bowl writers and the rabbis and their teachings complicate views of the rabbis as purveyors of elite culture and challenges the popular elite dichotomy that has been applied to rabbinic Judaism. On a social level, the clear scribal nature of the incantation bowls challenges the common scholarly perception of the ancient Jewish magician. There is no rabbinic term to designate these magicians, and certainly no pejorative term, as the practice of writing an amulet is expected to be known by the rabbis themselves, or we have the phrase, kamea min ha-mumche, an amulet by an expert. The bowl writers may have been viewed as a religious elite, consulted at times of need. Indeed, challenging the popular elite dichotomy is true not only on the social or professional level. We may even go one step further by challenging the categorical dichotomy between law and magic as forms of high scholastic versus low popular cultural expressions, such binaries that are so popular in scholarship. As we have seen, the magical texts themselves are replete with legal formulae. And it seems reasonable to assume that for the scribes of the Babylonian incantation bowls, the lines between magic, law, and religion were not rigid and perhaps non-existent. This holds true not only for the magical material. When we examine the nature of many rabbinic texts, the boundaries between what we may call magic and what we may call law simply do not hold. One example of this is rabbinic discussions of excommunication, as Jason Mkhitaryan demonstrated. Others include legal oaths, vows, and legal documents. To conclude, I have argued today for a vision for rethinking Babylonian Jewish society, in this case, by rigorously incorporating the ever-growing corpus of the Babylonian incantation bowls into our models. I began by proposing an identification of the social and professional context of the bowl writers. I then argued that the Jewish bowls should not be seen as a homogenous corpus reflecting popular beliefs. Rather, they were produced by various groups of scribes, some of whom displayed expert knowledge of a variety of Jewish motifs and attest to veneration of the rabbis. In terms, the rabbis themselves did not live in splendid isolation, and rabbinic texts can be understood in new ways. My work has focused only on a small part of the vast potential of incorporating magical materials in the study of rabbinic Judaism. My current project, for example, deals with questions of the everyday lives of Jews in the late Sasanian Empire, such as their daily concerns and fears, the spiritual world which they lived, the place of the rabbis, connection between Jews and non-Jews, and more. In these areas as well, the bowls not only enrich our historical knowledge, but also push us to change the paradigms through which we perceive Judaism at this formative time. Thank you to all of you invisible people.
Well, thank you so much for that just wonderful talk. It was really illuminating for me and I'm sure all of the guests. We have a lot of questions to get to. We only unfortunately have about 15 minutes or so. So I'm gonna have a difficult decision of choosing which questions to ask, and my apologies to all of you if I don't get to all of them. I would like to start with the following question to you. What is the consensus among scholars as to why this seems to have been a Jewish specialty? Does it suggest any new insight as to the general situation of Jews and Jewishness in this larger society? And as a follow-up to that, the person who asked the question asks, I'm presuming that many bowl writers appear to have been written for non-Jewish clients. Did this have to do with Jewish literacy only, or perhaps with the quote, Jewish mystique as well?
I'll start with the first question and then I'll forget the second. So please remind me.
Sure.
It's not just a Jewish specialty. I now focused on the bowls written in Jewish, Babylonian, Aramaic. As I mentioned, there's Syriac bowls and there's Mandaic bowls. So the Mandaic bowls have a lot of Mandaean religion. We could see different things that are unique to that kind of, to Mandaeans. But it is true, on the other hand, that most of the corpus, I don't know if I said this, but around two-thirds are of the bowls are is Jewish material. And what Shaul Shaked said about this, and I'll quote him, is that the reason that the bowls are sort of opposite to the place of society, the Jews are the smallest community but have the most bowls, is because many times magic powers or ritual powers are ascribed to smaller communities or different communities. So the Jews maybe would have been seen as some people who have special powers, as we could see in later periods. That's sometimes the situation about certain communities that certain small communities that are seen in that way. I hope that answered the question. What was the second question?
I'm presuming that many bowls appear to have been written for non-Jewish clients. Did this have to do with Jewish literacy only, or perhaps with the Jewish mystique as well?
Okay, so the Jewish mystique, I think I answered. Regarding who were the clients, that's a very that's a question that unfortunately we can't give a good answer to, because as you saw in the examples that I gave, we have Persian names. And the question is if the Persian names mean that it wasn't a Jewish client, because sometimes we have a list of the family and there are in the family Persian names as well as Jewish names. And then that could mean that these were Jews. So we really don't know who were the clients and if Jews were writing to non-Jews. I think that most scholars would say that they are, at least in some cases. I think the best example for that is there are a few bowls that have a Jewish Babylonian inscription, but in the rim of the bowl or the external side of the bowl, there is a instruction in Middle Persian to bury in, I don't know, the entrance of the home. So maybe that is for Middle Persian reading people, which could be non-Jews, could be Jews. So this is a big question, but if it is Jews writing for non-Jews, it could have to do with the mystique or, and in terms of literacy, it's very hard for me to answer if the Jews were more literate than others. I mean, I guess this is something that has been studied in other periods, but I think it's impossible to give an exact answer to that.
Okay, next question. You've held that the deed of divorce, a get, was a literal legal document. What does this say about the status of demons in late antique Babylonia? Were the demons perhaps considered to be some kind of person?
Okay, so I think that it has to do with the status and it doesn't. There isn't an issue with demons conjoining humans, that there is a fear of some sort of sexual joint if it's female Liliths for males and male Liliths for females, male Lilies or whatever. And so this could have to do with it, that in a way. But on the other hand, I think that the Jews of Sasanian Babylonia were using everything they could in their power to expel and banish the demons. So together with the divorce, we also have, as Jason has written about, the excommunication. So when you, and we saw this with the excommunication in the name of rabbis. So they're also using excommunication formula, just as they're using divorce. So on the one hand, yes, I think it does have to do with a certain connection, but on the other hand, it also has to do with just how can we expel demons. We could use what we know. What we know is legal adjurations and other, things that work in the human realm.
Okay, wonderful. Next question. Is there any pattern in the bowls that have illustrations on them? That is to say, is there always a connection between the content and the illustration in the case of demon illustrations, etc.? And if I could just actually follow up on that, does that play any role in the work that you've done on differentiating between scribal guilds?
Okay, so in terms of the first question, there usually isn't a connection that we know of. Sometimes, and this I recommend Naama Vilozhny's work, who also speaks about this. There are a few bowls that said this is the demon or this is the Lilith, but usually we don't know exactly what is the connection, and we're not even sure that the same hand that drew the illustration is the same hand that wrote the bowl. In terms of on the work that I mentioned of Simcha Gross and I of distinguishing different bowls, we did see, but there's still a lot of work to do in this, that a lot of the more Jewish, the bowls with a lot of Jewish clusters, or there aren't pictures of demons. If you remember in my presentation, in the bowl that quotes the Mishnah, there is some sort of image, but not of a person or demon, which is interesting because we know the problematics of drawing figures. So, but this is something we just did preliminary research. I think there may be a connection, but there's still more to do on that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next question. Do we know of any professional titles in surrounding cultures for those who have made, who may have been experts in dealing with protecting people against malevolent forces that might offer a compelling comparison?
That's a very good question. Well, there are in when we have there's a book of Theodore de Bruyne who speaks about Christian magic in Egypt, and there with Christians it's a bit easier because we have descriptions of priests writing magical amulets. So that would be sometimes priests. I think that we don't necessarily have to go to other religions because we have in the Talmud or that story of rabbis writing amulets, or in the Tanaitic literature and later also in the Talmud, the amulets by an expert, kameh min ha-mumcheh. So the answer is there. And I think that the reason we or scholars in their publications tend to call them magicians or exorcists, et cetera, doesn't have to do necessarily with the materials that are before them, but more maybe certain biases or thoughts about magic, about what magic is.
Okay, terrific, thank you. Okay, next question. Were the people at this time period just feeling the demons around them? Or were there times when they could see the demons, and how do they know the identities of these demons?
Okay, so usually on the one hand, demons are invisible, as I said in the beginning of my lecture, and we see that in rabbinic literature that they say that demons are all around. On the other hand, demons can take forms of either humans or animals. And one interesting thing, I didn't show this, but on a lot of illustrations, the demons have chicken feet, and there is a passage in the tractate Brachot that talks about if you want to see a demon, and you guys could try this at home, put dust on your bed when you go with dust, sorry, dust next to your bed when you go to sleep. And when you wake up in the morning, if you see chicken footprints, then it means there's a demon there. So there's one sort of answer. But again, demons, I didn't show this, but in the bowl with all of the different clusters of Jewish material, the bowl is, if you appear as a pig, I adjure you with this. If you appear as a ram, I adjure you with this. So they could take form of others. And this is also mentioned in the Talmud that demons could take form of other things.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Since the scribes were so educated and showed knowledge of legal language, were the people who received the bowls able to understand them themselves?
That's an excellent question. Unfortunately, we don't know if they... I imagine that's part of the bowls. I talked about bowls that were written for a rabbinic client. And even if this is the rabbis we know from the Talmud, or if it isn't, it is very rare that we find a name with rabbi. So I believe, or I think that is reasonable to assume that the bowls that were for rabbis were for people who were knowledgeable and could read it. I also think that many of the bowls weren't that also illiterate people purchased bowls. And this also connects to the question of pseudoscript bowls. Were the pseudoscript bowls, such as those that we've seen, were they charlatans, or I don't know, you could find a different word, or people who are trying to imitate, and then they were selling it to people who didn't know how to read? So I think the answer is complex in that way.
Okay, thank you. So we just have about 5 minutes left. And again, my sincere apologies to those of you who are asking questions that we don't get to. There's a lot of questions here. So the next one that I'll read is the following. Are we able to tell between guilds and traditions that created these bowls? Idol worship or Avodah Zarah is a giveaway, but there were many other masorahs or traditions at that time and location.
This is an excellent question. So that is what the project I talked a little about with differentiating between the different bowls, but let's take the Jewish cluster bowls. So if we think about it, we could imagine, if you remember that slide with all the different, you know, mystical literature, liturgy, etc., we imagine a different diverse library, or not with scare quotes, with all different kinds of texts? And then who are the people who would have access to such a wide variety of texts? Is it rabbis? Is it people that are engaged in mystical traditions? So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, when we have bowls such as the bowl that we see, we saw the invocation of the Trinity. So in that, so are we speaking in that about Jewish Christians? I know obviously this is a big question, or bowls so with more Mandaic formulas, so are these Jews that are connected to the Mandaean? So this is always the difficulty to make the jump between, you know, making the distinctions on paper and then jumping from the distinctions on paper to the social aspects. Are these bowls representing communities, and what communities are they representing? So I will leave it in a certain question, because I think there still needs to be more research that I will hopefully do, and hopefully get closer maybe to some answers.
Maybe. Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Always more questions than answers when it comes to the bowls. Next question, and hopefully we can ask one more final question after this. This question is there any evidence within rabbinic literature of knowledge of usage of these bowls? And if there's not, what do you make of that?
Okay, so there is one story in Tractate Moed Katan of, I'll say this very quickly, of it's in page 17 if you want to see, but and Gideon Boak wrote about this, about a violent man who was upsetting the rabbis, and then the rabbis tell him to write an excommunication, bury it in a jar, and do this sort of ritual. And at the end, the jar explodes and the violent man dies. Now, so it's burying. This is not exactly a bowl, but it's in burying an excommunication. So it is similar to the bowls. So we on the one hand, we don't have a description of bowls, but we have that. And we have many mentions of amulets. And many of these bowls start with an introductory formula. This is an amulet. So I think that to your question, Jason, about what do I make of this, I think that the reason we found so many bowls is because they were buried. But I believe that these people had lots of more amulets that they wore, that they hung in their house, or that were all around. So I think that when rabbinic literature talks about amulets, they are talking also about bowls and also about many other amulets that we don't have.
Great, thank you. So we'll end with this question, which I think is a nice question to end with. And then we'll say thank you. Since you argue that the term magician is not an adequate word to use, is there another term you think should be used instead? So what should we be referring to the sorcerers as, in your opinion?
So I use the word scribes usually, or I also try to be consistent, but I think specifically with the bowls, I mean, even you could try this at home. Taking a bowl, writing tiny letters in a spiral fashion is very, very difficult. And I think that even before the legal terminology, the material aspect, it points to scribes. So I think the most precise way to describe them is scribes. But this is right for the bowls. For the amulets, it would be something else, engravers or practitioners, which is maybe better. But you know, I'm sitting here in Jerusalem and you're asking me about English terms. So maybe I should ask the listeners who their English is probably better than mine.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful talk and for doing all the questions, for answering all the questions. On behalf of Cornell and the Jewish Studies program, thank you again for taking the time to speak to us. And this is a wonderful talk. So thank you to all the attendees as well. We hope to see you at future events. And just a quick reminder, there's an event this Wednesday at 5 p.m. So thank you all for attending. And I'll let everybody go right on time. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you. Goodbye.